Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
As they can see, this is stuff I don't want in my life. As I was saying, they can choose to walk it back. But one of the things you have to do is you have to recognize first that the abusive way of life is not all there is. And so with all of my work, including this one, I wanted to try to shock people into the recognition that this way of being in the world is not natural or inevitable.
That's the voice of Derek Jensen. On this week's show, Sylvia interviews Derek about his book Monsters. So stay tuned.
Today, we are very privileged to have Derek Jensen. He is the author of many prolific books. We are talking today about his latest, Monsters, a book of stories that brings us closer to what matters most. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always a joy to speak with you.
One of the things I love most about your writing is that it is lyrical and it's like this beautiful warm blanket embracing me on a cold night. And when I opened your book, Monsters, at first I was wondering, you know, what adventure you would take me on. And what I love was from the beginning of your book, your quote, and I'm just going to read it and start there. You said, "Can I describe how I feel within the context of our culture? Perhaps like a hurricane tethered to a bullet train. Sometimes, as though the part of my brain that processes time is broken. Sometimes, maybe other parts too, as if a clown and a caricature rather than real. As if while finding beauty in the complexity, I become caught in the gears. As if I'm alone even when I'm not. Sometimes." And I wanted, if you could start there, because I think this is a feeling many of us are experiencing at the moment.
Well, I think there's a line in another of my books that a lot of people refer to, and it's that in order to stop the atrocities, we need to step away from the isolation, and there's a whole world waiting for us, ready to welcome us home. And we work so hard to keep ourselves separate from the world. Several years ago, I heard some astronomer talking about why he thought that we needed to explore Mars, and his answer to that question was that he said that exploring Mars would answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? When he said that, I was thinking, that guy's crazy, because how can you ask if we're all alone when we're surrounded by all of this extraordinary life? And so many people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being on the planet is that generally even the most open-minded Westerners perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor as opposed to the way that the world really is. And most of us perceive the world as consisting of all these resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. So on one level, monsters take a story from the perspective of a vampire, or take a story from perspective of some other being, and to just spin out the story from that perspective. So on one level, there's that. And I mean, on another level, they're just, I don't mean to say just stories, because stories are how we learn how to be human, and stories are how we learn how to be who we are in any case. But that said, I didn't set out to write a bunch of stories that are going to be didactic and teach us how to be human beings. Instead, I set out to write a bunch of stories about monsters, and that's where they ended up.
One of the stories that you write, you title Killer, and just, you know, and the first paragraph really gripped me. You wrote, "It is a pleasure to kill. I could describe to you that pleasure in great, gory, pornographic detail that would make your groin thrive. with a burning ache that would never go away. I could feel histories with descriptions of the different ways I've killed, of the different reasons I've killed, of the different longings I've fulfilled. I could tell you of the stabbings, beatings, floggings, beheadings, crucifixions, burnings, shootings, poisonings, slow strangulations, disembowelments, dismemberings, exsanguinations, drop by drop. I could tell you how it tastes to lap up oozing blood from a wound I just made, and what it's like to smell someone's last breath. This paragraph alone just, it tore at me because I lived in a country at war. And I wonder, seeing the mutilated bodies on the streets that we found each morning, and I wonder, holding my own people, you know, when their last breath, I wonder, you know, what the person, what the people, the soldiers that were trained and dehumanized to be killers experience. Perhaps you've captured that, perhaps. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this.
Well, I'm really glad you picked up on that particular story, because and I'm going to sort of spoil this for listeners, that, you know, I have stories in there about trolls and leprechauns and various other monsters, and that particular story is not about a supernatural monster. That is exactly what you've described. That one is a soldier. That one is a member of this culture as it's exsanguinating the entire world. That particular story is about the training that it takes to objectify the entire world until you can destroy it, until you can have it rationalized that what you're doing becomes a pleasure. It becomes what you do and what you live for. For what it's worth, the first line from that story, I got the inspiration for it from, I believe, the first sentence of Ray Bradbury. And so I've always loved that as a first line of a book. And so I wanted to make a story based on it. And really, I don't know if I've said this to you before, but for me, a lot of times, the first sentence of an essay or a book or a story is the most difficult. And then everything else in the story will quite often be sort of a reeling in of that first sentence. That whole story really was already in the first sentence. And in many ways, much of the point of the book is to say that when we think about monsters, we think about, you know, like I said, trolls or vampires or whatever, but there can be nothing more monstrous than to separate yourself from the world and to then take pleasure in killing the world. You know, I was thinking a lot, and you brought up soldiers. That's part of the training for becoming a really good soldier. There's, God, what was his name? There's Grossman, I think is his name, wrote some really good books about how in war, quite often, and this was more of a problem before they had professional armies, but quite often soldiers will miss intentionally, and they're notoriously bad shots. And the reason they're bad shots is not because they've not been trained how to shoot well. The reason they're bad shots is because nobody wants to kill somebody. You have to train people in order to get them to be essentially killing machines, which is of course one of the points of boot camp, is to get them to break their previous allegiances and make their allegiance to that military unit, and then to train people to be able to be efficient killers.
As we speak, we are witnessing boats arriving on the borders of Venezuela, and what they're doing is exactly what you're pointing out. They're bringing recruits from other places, people that don't know, you know, the people there. Because the crime the Venezuelans have committed is they happen to have one of the largest oil supply in their soil, and the U.S. wants this oil, and so they will do what they do. To take their resources. Now, the Venezuelan economy has been crushed by a multitude of actions, the sanctions, the fact that the local elites, you know, who still control a large part of the economy, have stopped production and choked it from inside and choked it from outside from all the sanctions. But at the end of it, you know, I think a people can only be taken down when the people lose their will to live. And in your stories, you point out how our ideas are stronger, you know, than the body. I wonder if we can talk a little bit about that spirit, because although we have been domesticated, our bodies have been domesticated to work in the machinery that creates death, that creates war, that plunders, that robs, that, you know, builds empire and dehumanizes soldiers so that they can become, you know, cogs in that machinery. We also have the ability to imagine, to recreate, to rewrite the story of who our monsters are, who the real monster is, and to create a different fairy tale of our lives.
This is one of the reasons I so love being interviewed by you, is that you always get to the core of everything, and that really is the core of everything. That so many Indigenous people have said to me that the first and most important thing that we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what part of what I take that to mean is that we need to sort of undo that process by which we have been turned into the monsters that this culture makes us. You and I have talked before, and I've written before about how my father was extremely violent, and everyone in my family has PTSD, and everyone in my family is messed up in our own ways. And one of the most wonderful things that my mother ever did for me was, you know, I said I wanted to become a writer, and I was in my 20s, I was pretending to be a writer, but I wasn't doing much writing. And then in my early 30s, she and I had a series of conversations about it and about my childhood and about everything. And one of the things she said to me is that she knew that I'd never had a childhood, and she knew that if I was ever going to have a happy and productive adulthood, I needed time to vomit up the effects of that course of upbringing, that violent upbringing. And one of her favorite things to say about any situation was, you know, it took you a long time to get sick, and it'll take you a long time to get better. And this is about physical illness. This is about anything. And she gave me that time. And what I'm trying to get at is that the processes through which we are traumatized out of our being and into becoming these sort of crazed creatures, crazed beings, those processes can, with time and attention and a lot of hibernation, can be reversed. And a lot of my work is to help people reverse those processes. And one of the things that's required is a change of perspective, because one of the things that happens when you are in some sort of abusive situation is that one of the central things is that the abuser has to get you to perceive everything from their perspective, and to perceive what is happening as natural or inevitable and not as a series of choices. For people who have not undergone trauma, you know, a lot of this connection can be really first nature, as it's supposed to be. And for those who've undergone trauma and had some of those connections severed a bit, it can be one of the things that they at least can get out of this, if they can get some perspective, is they can see, this is stuff I don't want in my life. As I was saying, they can choose to walk it back. But one of the things you have to do is you have to recognize first that the abusive way of life is not all there is. And so with all of my work, including this one, I wanted to try to shock people into the recognition that this way of being in the world is not natural or inevitable.
It's like one of your stories, you know, this female troll is asking the bird, right? And the bird says, but this is my home. This is where I live. And in so many ways, we are going to encounter trolls in this world, you know, and they won't look like the disfigure images that we have consider. They might have even high positions of power, you know, even lead countries. And yet we have to be able to stand and recognize this is our home. And our home is more than just a building, or our home is more than just the factory we work at. Our home is also the land. Our home is also the waters. Our home is also the mountains. Our home is also the air we breathe. To see the connection, that relationship that you talk so beautifully in all your stories as being essential to everything we go through, whether it's, you know, just surviving and watching something or someone we love die, is that connection that keeps us going, that keeps us re-envisioning, and keeps us taking one step, one more step, even though we are fatigued.
The genesis of the whole series of troll stories was pretty simple. It was that the sort of mythology of trolls, that they live under bridges. And I started thinking, so where would some wild creature whose habitat is under bridges, where would that creature normally live? Because bridges aren't natural. And then it's like, well, maybe it's because it lived under logs, like bears will sleep under logs. But of course, old growth forests are being, you know, in natural forests, and dead wood downed on forests is being destroyed all over the world. So they have to live under bridges as secondary, you know, that's better than nothing. That's the habitat they move to. And so the whole story developed from there. And those stories, the risk of ruining them, is the stories are about the trolls and others then fighting for their habitat.
What inspires you, you know, as you write your stories? Because when I read your stories, I am moved in so many ways to see the spark within all of us to imagine, to create beauty even out of the chaos. And so I wonder, you know, and I think, what inspires you? Because there's also a lot of things that take us down, but what keeps you, you know, in motion? What keeps you vibrant, full of possibilities, even when things seem dark and scary?
Well, it's my love for the natural world, and how heartbroken I am every day that the world is being destroyed, and the recognition that this is the real world, and there is only, that we know of, this one world, and any humans or non-humans who are alive in 100 years from now are going to be asking us what was wrong with us that we didn't fight as hard as we could when the world was going down. You know, we all have different gifts, and for better or worse, one of the gifts I have is the ability to write, and so I'm going to use that gift in the service of the land. And so on one level, I mean, that's what keeps me going. So that's sort of the grand overarching scheme. And then on the individual level, it will just be taking one image or one idea and then running with it. The short story is not my native form. And it's like a short essay is not really my native form either, because some people, ideas come very, very easily. And then, you know, Ray Bradbury would write a story a week. And he would have lots of ideas. And I don't generally have lots of ideas. It's much easier for me to take one idea and then spin it into, you know, the book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. I have some exchanges with Chris Hedges, and I'm just astounded that he can put out a really good column every week. And I can produce the same amount of volume of work, but for me, coming up with the idea is the hardest part. And then once the idea is there, then, and Ray Bradbury talked about it, was for him it was the opposite, that the editing and the actual putting together the idea was much more difficult for him than the idea was. Anyway, so we could talk about the individual germs for the different stories. I've mentioned a couple of them, and that for me that's the limiting resource. So you have the two different levels. On one level, what keeps me going is the larger work, and what inspires me on an individual story would, of course, just be, the story about the guardian angel. It started off with what would happen if you had a guardian angel who hated her job, and so she would try to get you killed. It was just going to be slapstick of a guardian angel who's just really, really, who's intentionally bad. And then I was thinking, that wouldn't really work because she would lose her position right away. And then I started thinking, well, okay, so what if she's just incompetent? And so then I started playing that out for laughs. And then the whole story just developed. I don't want to spoil this one. The whole story developed that you have this guardian angel who is, in fact, not protecting people, but instead just messing up left and right. And then how could you make this work so that the person, the angel, would continue doing the work? And then we find out more things about the angel later as to why this is working out the way it is. See, here's one of the interesting things about writing is that who you are will come out. And when I was writing a story, any of the stories, I didn't worry about what message I'm trying to get across. Instead, I was just trying to tell the story. And the reason I'm comfortable doing that, even though my work is heavily based on, you know, getting across a message, is that no matter what your beliefs are, they will come across in your work. I just read this thing a couple days ago about a bunch of dark backstories behind famous movies and like how the movie was developed. And, you know, it's no wonder that so much mainstream film is really just awful and really woman-hating, because so many of the people who create it, you know, we all know about Weinstein at this point, and we all know about, you know, we've all heard of the casting couch that directors and producers will really essentially force women to have sex with them in order to be in films many times. And we all know of the existence of those. And any person who is that way, any person who has that much contempt and objectifies women that much, that cannot but come out in the movie and in the things they create. As I was writing each story, I wasn't worried about the message at all. I was just worried about the story, because who I am means that the message will come through in every sentence and in every word. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? It's like you could not, maybe you could, but I don't think you could. You couldn't do an interview that was, and you couldn't create something that was different than your heart. So again, on the larger scale, what inspires me is protecting the natural world and my love for the natural world. But I don't worry about that as I write at all, because it's always going to come out.
That is such a beautiful note to end our interview on, because I think what you're inviting us is to be more of what makes our heart thrive. To be, you know, if community is what makes your heart sing, if building community, then do more of that, right? If creating more just ways in our judicial system is, well, then do more of that, you know. And if creating beauty and painting amazing paintings that bring people to be more reflective about, you know, what matters most to us, what matters, and how do we protect life, then, you know, that's also a way we co-create the world in beautiful ways. So if you were to have one, I guess, your most profound invitation to our audience, what would that be?
Well, it would be to find what your particular gifts are and to develop those gifts and then to use them in the service of your larger community, and which includes the land. Individually, it doesn't have to include the land, because I always think about my friend Charlotte Watson. She's a wonderful, wonderful human being, and she has dedicated her life to stopping men's violence against women. And I would never ask her to stop doing that and start working on salmon issues. That's one of the things about everything being, one of the great things about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's really good work to be done. And so just find what your gifts are, find what you love, and then defend your beloved.
It's so beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us today. How can people access your book, Monsters, and all the other wonderful gifts you have written for us over the years?
Well, you can go to my website, which is www.derrickjensen.org, derrickjensen.org. You can also, the books are available at libraries, at bookstores. Yeah, the books should be available anywhere.
Thank you again for being with us today.
Oh, thanks so much. Thank you.
Take care.
We got a little time left, so let's end the show with a song by David Rovix, We Are Everywhere. See you next time.
When I say the hungry should have food, I speak for many. When I say no one should have seven homes, while some don't have any. Though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. Say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways, victories or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration that we are everywhere. We are everywhere.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.